Okay. Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure, as always, to be here. And so Rob asked me to come and give a talk, and I said, what do you want me to talk about? And he said he would like me to give a talk that sort of set a larger context towards thinking about the role of evolution in understanding biology. So that's what I've tried to do. Everything that's going to appear here is published. So if you're a geezer who wants brand new stuff, you can leave now. Okay? So I wanted to start with some questions. And so, you know, ultimately there are two versions of understanding biology. One is we will collect vast amounts of data, and we will couple that data together by, you know, using big data and Sergey Brin and a variety of other things. And as a result, in the end, you will be able to say, you know, delete this gene, this is the way the organism will behave, or you'll be able to take samples of people's blood and you'll be able to predict exactly how long they will live and what they should eat and stuff. But if you ask the computer why it makes that prediction, even though the prediction is completely accurate, they'll just be sort of fizzing in sparks, and perhaps the answer 42 will come out at the other end. And so what traditionally scientists are interested in doing is finding explanations that satisfy human curiosity. And so what I'm going to do on this slide is just to list, at least for me, some of the questions that I think need to be answered, at least to explain my curiosity about how biology works. So they are, how do collections of little things make big ones with novel properties? So Matt just talked about this problem of how do you figure out how big a spindle should be inside a cell, and it's just worth mentioning, you know, there are lots of questions about measurement in biology. And typically the objects that make the structure, like tubulin molecules, have diameters on the order of nanometers. It's about 5 nanometers for a tubulin molecule. The cell, if it's a Xenopus egg, can have a diameter in millimeters. The reaction scale, the binding and unbinding of tubulin you get as microtubules polymerize and depolymerize, those reactions have time constants measured in milliseconds, whereas the spindle assembles over minutes and disassembles over minutes. So there's this enormous disparity between the scales of the actors that do things, the little things, and the big things that have novel properties, both in terms of time and distance and behavior. And that's obviously a place where talking to physicists ought to be able to help us. There's the question of how organisms evolve to survive and reproduce, which we'll talk more about. There's this interesting question of to what extent can general principles explain biology, and even what do we mean by a principle? And I guess that's something that could be talked about over both beer and coffee. And then there's this important question to me about what is the proper interaction between theory, experiment, and computation in biology, and it comes back to this general principles issue. So physicists, at least as I understand them, run around with a small number of laws and a bunch of useful mathematical tools like Fokker-Planck equations and Lyapunov exponents and all sorts of other stuff that they've learned. And it's just a sort of suitcase that they carry around. And with that small number of things and Boltzmann distributions and so on and so forth, they can, if you reduce the world enough and make the cow spherical, explain all sorts of things because there's a very small number of laws that have to be followed, you know, laws of thermodynamics, etc. And so the question is, are there similar things in biology? Are there general principles beyond evolution by natural selection, modular design? If they are, what are they? Can they be reduced to mathematical formalisms? Can those mathematical formalisms not only make predictions that can, I guess the simplest way. So the first level of doing math and physics is to say, is what we know consistent with the equations? Then can you make predictions? Can you test those predictions, and can they be verified by experiment? And the most interesting thing, and the place where I think using the formalism of mathematics and physics helps us the most, is you take some phenomenon you think you understand, you make a model, a simple model, and then you find that the model makes what you think of as a biologist as counterintuitive predictions, and then you test those predictions and find out that they're verified, because now you've really learned something that you didn't know before. And so one of the questions is, that's clearly possible for sort of small individual sets of things that do something in biology. Can this be expanded to cover all of biology? Is there some theory of biology that can explain how everything works? And that, to me at least, is an open question, is one of the reasons I'm a biologist. Okay. And that sort of comes back, I mean, I was just piffling about, in a sense, what is it that we need to explain, and on what level can we explain things at? Okay. So the most important thing to say is, this is not our Milky Way because we're in it, so we can't take a picture of it, but this is a Milky Way that, according to Wikipedia, looks much like ours. Okay? This object, outside theology, has no purpose. Okay? It's just there. Okay? But this is not what we are. Organisms have purposes. They are vehicles to disperse genes through time and space. This is a fictional one, but it occupied a lot of people as children. And actually, some grown-ups still dress up to reenact parts of it. Okay? And the other thing is, it seems a little unlikely that there's anyone here who doesn't believe that evolution actually works, but in case you don't, you can watch evolution occur within individual human bodies. I will buy a beer for anyone who comes up afterwards and tells me who the two individuals are. You have to get both, okay? And don't shout them out, because then it doesn't work. Okay, so here's what evolution depends on. And it's worth reminding you of this. Again, you know, like you all know this, but it's worth just making it explicit. So it depends on inheritance. The offspring have to be like the parents, because otherwise the parents' success is not going to be relevant to the offspring. It depends on mutation. Some of the offspring have to be different subtly from the parents. And it depends on selection, that some genotypes in certain environments leave more progeny than others. It's important to remember that selection is not perfect, that genetic drift occurs, and therefore alleles that are less fit can, under certain circumstances, fix. So why do we have trouble understanding evolution? If we understood evolution, I could be home, playing video games and driving race cars around imaginary racetracks. So the first one is that evolution is dominated by a succession of extremely rare events. Okay. And second, and this is a thing that I think I have had, you know, it took me probably 20 years to really absorb this, is that evolution is determined by the relative probability of events, and it's the combination of these two. So you can have some succession of ridiculously rare events, but if they are more probable than any other succession of ridiculously rare events, that's what will happen. And the last thing, which is a little bit obvious, I guess, is who doesn't know what the TARDIS is? Okay, it's interesting to see the distribution. Okay, the TARDIS is the vehicle in which Doctor Who travels through time. Okay, and so sometimes I show a picture of it. But even if you don't know what it is, that it's a police box that Doctor Who goes into to travel. A police box. Excellent. So in England in the olden days, there used to be these objects. They were physical objects. You could open a door and call the police before, I guess, there were phone boxes. Okay. So the approach I'm going to talk to you about today in terms of understanding evolution is to do experimental evolution, to do evolution in the laboratory. And so what I need to do now is explain why this is good and why this is a bad way of studying evolution. Okay, so I'll start with the advantages. So one of the big advantages is you know where you start. You have a clonal population of organisms whose genome you know, and if it's some well-studied organism like the brewer's yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, you know a lot of stuff about the biology of this organism. You apply a selective pressure, which at least to some extent you understand. And in the second half of the talk, I'll talk about an example where we didn't think hard enough, so that although the pressure was understandable in retrospect, we didn't actually understand it properly, and we got something different from what we expected, although it was interesting. You can keep a living fossil record. As long as you work on an organism where you can take samples of your population and freeze them, thaw them, and have them be alive. So to have them be alive, unfortunately, disqualifies Drosophila melanogaster, because you can't freeze, thaw, and bring back to life Drosophila. You can keep a frozen fossil record, so you can go back afterwards and ask retrospectively what happened at different time points during your experiment. You can interbreed the ancestral and the evolved form. So one of the problems with so there's this field called EvoDevo, which I presume you'll have speakers who represent, where you look at organisms which have diverged from some time in the past, and they're interestingly different, and you try and figure out how those differences arose and what are the genetic differences between two species, for example, that account for some interesting developmental or cell biological difference. To understand that, you have to be able to interbreed them, and if you remember, the classical biological definition of a species is if you're within a species, you can breed with it successfully, and if you're outside it, you can't. So it's fortunately true that there are various exceptions to that rule, closely evolutionarily related things, like sibling species of Drosophila. You can, to limited extent, interbreed and figure out these things. But what I'll point out is even in those studies, the mutations that you're looking at are the mutations that account for the difference now. They are not necessarily the mutations that originally arose and explained the differences, because those mutations could have become irrelevant and then lost again. Okay. And last but not least, we can do multiple parallel experiments. Stephen Jay Gould, who was one of the great popular writers about evolution, had this phrase about replaying the tape of evolution and that how this is impossible to do. And the nice thing about doing laboratory evolution is you can set up, in principle, as many experiments as you want. And for example, people like my colleague Michael Desai literally do thousands of parallel experiments, or Gavin Sherlock and Dan Fisher and Dmitry Petrov at Stanford, where they do thousands of experiments and they can do the sort of statistical analysis that a statistical physicist would like to do. We do things on a smaller scale where typically we do 6, 10, 12 parallel experiments. Unfortunately, there are also disadvantages. Okay? So economics keeps us from exploring population sizes that are even close in terms of orders of magnitude to the ones that exist in the real world, so that, for example, marine bacteria that fix carbon in the ocean have population sizes on the order of 10 to the 30th. You just can't do that in a lab. And time is limited. Students have to graduate, postdocs have to get jobs, papers have to be published, whereas the Earth has had about 4 billion years. The other thing that it is worth pointing out is that natural environments are enormously more complex. Okay? They vary over time, they vary over space, there are all sorts of biological interactions with other species. I'm going to talk a little later on about, I actually think this is not the biggest problem in the world if you're interested in particular aspects of evolution, in particular the evolution of novelty, and I'll explain what I mean by that. And as a result of these two problems, the relevance of what is done in the laboratory to long-term natural evolution is debatable. My philosophical position is that either things done in the laboratory will help people working in the field better test hypotheses about how evolution has worked, and some of those ideas at least will turn out to be right, or that won't be the case. If that's true, we will have had fun playing in the sand. And it also, I suspect, means that understanding what's happened in the real world, if none of the stuff that happens in the laboratory is relevant, will mean that what happens in the real world is ridiculously complicated and hard to understand. So we're essentially taking a gamble in the hope that we can take shortcuts to understanding. Okay. So I'm going to talk, I should have given you the 1-minute summary at the beginning. So there was going to be a bunch of general blather, which you've just had. Okay, and then I'm going to talk about two different sorts of questions that you can ask using laboratory evolution. So one is the sort that will appeal to statistical physicists, because it's a quantitative question about evolution, how evolution works. It's an example of whether theory can be helpful in understanding evolution, and particularly the sort of lunatic spherical cow type assumptions that statistical physicists made, whether these can be useful. And I will make the argument that at least in this one particular case, worrying about how fast evolution goes, that's useful. And then in the second part, which we will hopefully get to, I'll talk about a qualitative question about how evolution works, where it's much less clear that the same approach can be useful. And one of the things I'm going to be here for the next 2 weeks that would be interesting to talk to people about here is, for those qualitative questions, are there ways that theory can help us think about them? So since no one's asked a question yet, I will pause. Yes. That's a really good question. I mean, I guess I probably don't worry about the question as much as I should. Okay? Like, I'm just having fun doing what I'm doing, and that's not a very good excuse, is it? Let me think about that, and maybe we can talk about it later, because it's a good question. It's like, to what extent is the sort of evolution that's seen in HIV, for example, or flu, or tumors, or bacterial resistance, to what extent does it conform to principles, to what extent does it match what happens in laboratory evolution? And Boris, who's worked on flu with his colleagues, you know, would be a good person to ask that. That might even be worth having as sort of a general free-form discussion, like, to what extent does all that stuff fit together? Can I? Yes. Yeah.
Don't see any of the resistant mutations, which is really exciting because it means that a lot of drugs we've thrown out might actually be very effective, because the things that we think of as easy ways for resistance don't happen in patients. But I think that just stimulates you to think about how to actually test in the lab, how to figure out what the context is to then go test all the drugs. That's the only way you're going to be able to do it.
Right. That's why I think, you know, depending on what people want to do, it might be worth having a general discussion. So the way I took Kim's question was less, is it the same specific mutations you see when you do things, as are the general principles the same? And so, for example, I don't know if you guys are having Dmitry Petrov or not. Not? So what Dmitry has done is looked at, you know, the fixation of mutations in natural populations and shown that it actually, for Drosophila, for some things, it looks rather like you would expect in laboratory experiments where fixation is very fast and adaptive mutations have to pile up on top of each other and things like that. But the general question of how everything fits together is an important question. Yes, sorry. I will come back to that point, and I will argue that that's how novelty evolved in the real world, and that's not a difference. But so standard population geneticists get all hot and bothered about what you just said, so a general point that I will make is you can make all sorts of interesting novel traits just by killing genes, right? that bothers intelligent, or that's an argument that intelligent design people use, which is if when people evolve novelty in the laboratory, you do it by inactivating genes, and that's how it happened in the real world, and God gave us 4,000 genes to start with, there wouldn't be any left, and therefore God must have designed everything, and it's not evolution, right? Now, so you have to believe that as well as breaking genes, you can make genes. And the argument that I will make is that in the sort of Red Queen world, where everyone's running fast just to stay in the same place, you probably don't mostly evolve by inactivating genes, but under times when there are substantial rewards for doing things in new ways, and the pressure is, the winners are the people who figure out how to do things in new ways the fastest, because it's easier to break genes than to make genes. That's actually how it happens in the real world. That's total speculation, right? Just so I'm clear about it. Okay, quantitative question, how fast is evolution? So there are three approaches to understanding how fast evolution is. You can do experiments, okay? So for example, you can ask, how do you get yeast or E. coli to proliferate faster in low glucose concentration? Rich Lenski's lab in E. coli has been doing this experiment now for more than 100,000 generations. You can do theory, so I'm going to talk about work that Michael Desai did when he was a graduate student working with Daniel Fisher. You can do simulation, which is, so Michael did experiments in my lab. I can't understand the theory except in an intuitive way. So to see that they weren't lying, I did computer simulations because I can at least figure out how to do that. Okay. So what I need to talk about now is parameters that set the speed of evolution. So one of them is reproductive fitness, which population geneticists call W. And typically it is expressed relative to the mean fitness of the population, which is set at 1 because the idea is that the population is neither increasing nor decreasing over time. There's something called the effective population size. In lots of experiments, and the ones that I will describe that Michael did to test his theory, what happens is you allow cells to grow. This should really be log population size. And so the cells grow exponentially, and then you dilute them and they grow exponentially again. Okay, that's mathematically complicated. And so what theoretical population geneticists have done is to argue that you can find some effective population size here in red, where the population would behave the same at that constant size as it would as if it's really going up and down. And the important thing to say is that's okay in a sort of qualitative nasty sense, but the right effective population size that you should use depends very strongly on the sorts of mutations that you're thinking about. And yes, you can define it as being the harmonic mean of the actual population size over time, but that's only true really if you're looking at the fixation of neutral mutations, okay? So it's sort of a crutch. There's the beneficial mutation rate, the rate at which new better mutations arise. There's the deleterious mutation rate, the rate at which mutations that make organisms less fit arise. This is always, under any sane circumstances, going to be much higher than the beneficial mutation rate. There's the distribution of selective coefficients. So S is the extent to which a mutation makes an individual fitter if S is greater than 0, or less fit if S is less than 0 than its ancestors. And there's going to be some distribution where the probability of having big S, so here they're positive, more beneficial mutations, will fall probably quite steeply as the benefit goes up. Okay, and there's all sorts of fancy arguments about what this curve looks like. And there are people now from these statistical large-scale experiments where you do many parallel replicates who are actually measuring this distribution. There's epistasis, the interaction between mutations. So imagine that you have two mutations, which we will call 1 and 2. Each of them makes organisms more fit. And so the question is, what is the fitness contribution of the double mutant, that means you have both 1 and 2, relative to just adding the fitness advantages of mutation 1 and mutation 2? And if delta is 0, there is no epistasis. If delta is bigger or less than 0, there's epistasis. The mutations don't just interact linearly.
Down the road. some sense, there's a sequence space that you're doing is random walk on. At some point, you have what it looks like a group extension of, but it looks like one step.
Well, you account for it through this. So that first mutation that has no effect until the second mutation would have S equals zero. But by, for example, changing, so imagine that delta is large and positive. S1 is zero. S2 is less than zero, so it was deleterious in the absence of the first mutation. As long as delta is larger in magnitude than S2 because it's positive, now the second mutation is beneficial, but only in the background of the first. So yes, in principle. Happy? Absolutely.
I think what you're referring to is adaptive evolution in some sense, not evolution.
Actually, sorry. What I'm talking about here in this particular slide, thank you, that's very helpful. All evolution means is a change over time in the frequency of alleles in genes, and as Mike absolutely importantly and correctly points out, those mutations need not be beneficial. And therefore, populations need not get more fit, and there need not be adaptation in the sense if adaptation means getting more fit in a given environment. So what I'm talking about here is parameters that, when I say evolutionary speed here, what I really mean is the rate of fitness increase, in which case we are talking about adaptation. But that's a very, very critical point to make. Thank you. Okay? And then there's sex, which adds all sorts of ridiculous complications. Okay? So the goal is very simple. It is, here's the rate of fitness. I should have a bar over here, so it would be the mean fitness of the population. It is the rate at which the mean fitness will change over time in some environment where we think things can adapt so the fitness will go up. And it's going to be, you know, I learned from physicists to write this fancy F, and then you have these brackets. That means it's a function of all these things. Okay? No problem. We're done. Right? So there are, unfortunately, some problems. The problems are that most of the quantitative parameters that appear in this equation, like it doesn't matter whether you know the form of the equation because we don't even know the numerical values of any of these parameters, right, in general, right? Like this one we can control. The mathematics is difficult even if we knew what the distributions are, okay? So there's no solution as yet to this equation, okay? And so what Fisher and Desai decided they would do is the worst sort of spherical cow assumption. So they're going to make a bunch of simplifications. The population size is going to be constant. All the advantageous mutations that occur in the population are going to have exactly the same fitness benefit. There are going to be no deleterious mutations. The mutations, the beneficial mutations, all of which have the same constant effect, are purely going to interact additively. There's no complicated epistasis. And lastly, at least because Fisher's father is British and I grew up in Britain and the British don't like this, there will be no sex. Okay? And so once you do that, you can work out the math. So the biologists here will be happy. You will be spared the math. The physicists will be sad. But I will try and give you an intuitive explanation. Yes? Oh, sorry. Okay, sorry. Excellent. All right, so here's the idea. So in these graphs, there are going to be the frequency of the genotypes. And each new beneficial mutation is going to give you a bump S in the fitness. We're going to ignore all mutations that don't change the fitness. Okay? So a beneficial mutation arises. Typically, these mutations will be lost by genetic drift, but some small fraction of them will survive. Once they exceed a certain number, their frequency will increase over time. So these guys go up in fitness, and the founding population goes down. Eventually, this population gets to be big enough that it starts to generate new mutations that will increase the fitness further at a rate that allows at least one of them to survive genetic drift. And so now its frequency goes up, its frequency is going up faster than the frequency of this class because it has a larger difference from the mean fitness of the population. And because the mean fitness of the population has increased, the fitness difference between the founding genotype and the mean fitness of the population has increased, so that frequency, the frequency of this class, starts to go down faster. And this goes on and on until eventually you get something that looks sort of like a steady state. These guys are going down like crazy. These guys are stationary because this is now the mean fitness. These guys are increasing faster, and eventually when this bar gets fast enough, new beneficial mutations will survive drift, and the whole distribution will shift over because selection is driving the guys at the back to extinction. New mutation is driving the front forward, and eventually those forces will balance, and the whole fitness distribution will just march right out into the Pacific Ocean. Okay? And in particular, if this distribution, at least over time and in simulations, what you can see is it gets a little wider and a little narrower sometimes as mutations are unusually, if new mutations are unusually slow to arise, it will get narrower. And if they arise unusually fast and survive distribution, it will get wider. But the wider it gets, the faster the tail gets extinguished, so it keeps trying to stay at some constant width. And you can write down separate equations for the rate at which the front should go forward and the tail should follow it to keep up. And so you can write down two separate equations. They have to give rise to the same rate, and you can do the math and solve all that stuff, and you get the following equation. Okay? So W is the mean fitness. S is the size, the benefit that these notional mutations all of exactly the same effect give. N is the population size. And UB is the beneficial mutation rate. Okay, so I've explained all the symbols in the equation. If you're good at math, you can look at this and see what it looks like. If you're not, the speed is roughly proportional to S squared times the log of the effective population size. And the speed increases with the log of the beneficial mutation rate. One of the things I should say that's super critical and should be clear, it's implied here, but I haven't said it clearly, is this is a situation where before any one mutation fixes, new beneficial mutations fall on top of it. If you work at very small population sizes where after a beneficial mutation survives drift, it fixes way before the next beneficial mutation survives drift, even I can work out the math for that. And it's actually an amusing exercise. Like, for those of you who are biologists, it's actually an amusing exercise to see if you can do that, because it's not that hard to do. Okay? So those are the predictions. And the important thing about this is it tells you that the rate of evolution goes up slowly, because it goes as the log, roughly, of the effective population size and the log, roughly, of the beneficial mutation rate. So making the mutations faster or the populations bigger doesn't speed up things as much as you might like. All right. So now I'm going to talk briefly about the experiments. Why do we do this in budding yeast? We do it because they grow rapidly. The doubling time in the lab is about 90 minutes. You can get it to proliferate sexually or asexually, which means you can do experiments about what does sex give and take away. It has excellent genetics. There are genome-based tools to find mutations, which I'll talk about very briefly at the end. Okay. And so what Michael did, so having done theory, he wanted to test his theory. And so he evolved cells to proliferate faster on low glucose concentrations. So you dilute the cells, you allow them to proliferate, you hope a new beneficial mutation arises, survives the next round of dilution, which is the genetic drift part, and gradually propagates through the population, and other mutations fall on top of that, and ultimately the fitness of the population goes up. Okay, so this is a description, a thumbnail description. This is done in rich medium, but with a much lower glucose concentration than normal. So the glucose concentration is down by a factor of 40. Pretty heroically, Michael kept all these populations in exponential growth. So what happens as they run out of carbon is the growth rate slows down, and now all sorts of complicated things happen. okay? And there are all sorts of mutations that are beneficial under those circumstances, which are not beneficial when the cells are growing flat out. And so what Michael did is just watched all these guys like hawks and diluted them before the growth rate started to slow down. He did this at three different effective population sizes, which span three orders of magnitude. And he used two different mutation rates. So as yeast comes to us by domestication, by humans from wild isolates, the mutation rate is about 5 × 10⁻¹⁰ per base pair per generation. Since the genome size of this organism is only about 10⁷ base pairs, this means roughly one mutation every 200 generations, okay? And many of those mutations will be phenotypically neutral. We used a mutator, which in our hands elevates this frequency by a factor of about 10, okay? And so here's the data from this experiment. So this is the average speed of adaptation. And this is the value, the relative value of the product of the effective population size times the beneficial mutation rate, okay? So there are two sorts of data here. The solid black circles are the wild type data. The red triangles are the mutator data. This blue curve is how the rate of evolution should scale with these things if mutations were fixing one by one. That is, if a beneficial mutation survived drift, went to fixation, all before the next beneficial mutation arose. Under those circumstances, the rate of evolution should be linear in the product of the effective population size and the beneficial mutation rate, which is why this curves up at this crazy angle. This clearly does not fit the data. Okay? Yes?
Is it obvious that the N that should be in the formula for the rate of evolution, or the rate of adaptation, should really be the variance effective population size of this harmonic mean? Because it seems to me like it's probably the parameter NUB is really, you know, the effective, the population beneficial mutation rate. And that's changing over the course of these, you know, serial dilutions. And there's a big difference between mutations that arise early in the cycle.
Well, the big difference, so the short answer to your question is this all works out about right, and you can do simulations and show that it works, or they can do theory. The sort of qualitative answer to your explanation is, right after dilution, the population size is extremely small. Mutations will be very rare, but there will be many copies of those mutants left by the time the dilution occurs, and so they're ridiculously rare, but if they happen, they have a relatively high chance of surviving dilution. Conversely, there will be many, exponentially many more cells in the last generation before dilution, so many more mutations will happen then, but there'll only be a single copy of each of those mutations. And if you dilute the thing by a factor of 10⁶, the chance that any of those mutations survive the dilution is ridiculously small, and roughly speaking, those two things cancel out. Okay? Okay? So, because we knew the effective population size, we know the mutation rate, and with stuff I'm not going to talk about in detail, Michael was able to measure the size of the typical beneficial mutation. There are, in fact, no free parameters in the fitting here. And so, the two symbols that I haven't explained, which are the open ones, are the theory for the mutator and the theory for the non-mutator. They don't lie on the same line because that equation was complicated, okay? And what you can see is within the variability of the experimental data, some of which is measurement error, but most of which is actually genuine stochastic variation between the rate of evolution in individual experiments, the theory fits the data. Okay? Yes, Sri. Yeah, absolutely. Under these particular set of conditions, yes. And one of the things I should have said is all those things like the distribution of the values of benefit or cost, S, and UB, are determined by the environment under which you do the selection. Right? Okay? So that's the end of the first part. Questions? Yes?
So the selection that you're applying in this case, is that simply ability to grow more quickly and more effectively in this set medium?
Yeah, it's the ability to grow better at lower glucose. So the concentration of glucose that people use in laboratory experiments, which is 2%, which comes out to be about 110 millimolar, is way higher than you need for the maximum growth rate. Okay? It's just what yeast geneticists like to do, because they want the cultures to grow fast for a long time. And so the concentration that Michael used is sufficiently low that the cells are growing lower than that maximal growth rate, and there are things they can do under those conditions of having low glucose to grow better. One of the things I should point out, these experiments were done in diploids, which means that if we try to figure out what the mutations are, the other thing to say is the fitness increases are relatively modest. The best of these populations got about 10% fitter over about 400 generations. Okay? So actually tracking down the mutations that were responsible is relatively non-trivial, and Michael, who has his own lab, and we have never bothered to go back and do it. And it's an interesting question as to what those mutations are, but we don't know, okay? And probably are never going to. People want to track them down, happy to send you the strains. Yes? Yeah? Oh, so I'm going to say something about, like, how can it work with this crazy assumption?
I was just trying to think what the assumptions were that were built into the selection and how that might fit with, say, either predator-prey relationships or complex communities of organisms, or what assumptions have you built into that?
So let me talk about the next thing and see if I answer the question, and if not, harass me. Okay? Right, so the last slide in this section is what about the lunatic assumptions, right? Because, I mean, it's clearly not true that all beneficial mutations have exactly the same fitness and there is no epistasis. Okay? So roughly speaking, I'm going to give you again a qualitative explanation. So Michael assumed there's this typical value S that all mutations have. In reality, there will be other mutations that give smaller benefits. But they are typically rendered unimportant by something called clonal interference, which is, yeah, those mutations can happen. But in the same population, there is likely to be, and remember these are asexual populations, so the mutations are not being recombined with each other. There's likely to be another lineage that has a bigger, better mutation, and it's always going to overtake the one that has the tiny one, okay, which is what's called clonal interference. So what about mutations that are substantially bigger than this typical value that he was worrying about? And the answer about those is, as long as the distribution of the probability of a mutation having a given benefit falls off steeply enough as the benefit goes up, even though these mutations, when they occur, will take over the whole population and eliminate its genetic diversity, they occur sufficiently rarely that statistically they have little effect on the net rate of evolution. And as a result of those two things that push in from either end statistically, evolution is dominated by a narrow range of fitness effects which can be approximated to one single value, S effective. Okay, and that's the value that Michael got out of looking at the distribution of fitnesses within his populations. And this is valid as long as the distribution of mutations with better and better fitness falls off at least exponentially fast. And that means there are reasons to actually measure that distribution and see what it looks like. Yes? Yeah, basically everything goes linearly in S effective, so it's actually quite sensitive to that, not non-linearly. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Did that get at your question, Joel?
Sort of. I guess I was trying. Your explanation of the glucose, which is the constant flow of glucose, is very helpful because it's a single sort of limited resource. This sort of selective coefficient simulates a single living resource in a single population environment.
Yeah.
And we can talk later about how you might deal with
more complicated things where things change. Absolutely. Yeah. We're doing things in the simplest possible world. So now we're going to switch to qualitative. So are there questions about quantitative? Okay. So the qualitative question is, how does novelty arise? Okay. And so the question is, what do we mean by novelty? So here is an evolutionary laboratory, the Hawaiian archipelago. Okay, so the Hawaiian Islands are formed because the crust passes over a hot spot in the mantle, and every so often the lava gets through, and you start with a volcano under the sea, and eventually it's above the land, and then the spot closes, things move on, and so the island moves off towards the Kamchatka Peninsula in Russia, which would be about there. Okay, so it's sort of a conveyor belt, one island per roughly million years. So the eldest of the current above-sea Hawaiian islands is about 8 million years old, and the Big Island is about a million years old. And the maps here, oops, because this distance is rather long. The prevailing winds go this way. So things get to Hawaii by being blown there or taken by ocean currents. So it's like a very cut price, like if you go from Europe, think Ryanair. Way of getting to the resort of your choice. It's Noah's Ark with very limited capacity. And as a result, crazy things have happened. So in the world, there are 3,000 species of Drosophilid flies. 700 of them are limited to the Hawaiian Islands, and the evolutionary, ecological, behavioral, morphological, developmental diversity of those 700 species on the Hawaiian archipelago vastly exceeds the other 2,300 in the rest of the globe. And presumably the reason that that happened is very few species of insect were lucky enough to have a single gravid female blown 2,000 miles to show up in the Hawaiian archipelago. Okay, this is just higher mag, and so you can see these are the islands that have sunk back beneath the waves. Okay. Ooh, what happened there? Oh, I'm pressing. Oh, shoot. Single. Too many buttons. Sorry, my bad. Okay. So things look different in Hawaii. So instead of using the flies as an example, I'm going to use these guys, which are. So this is a type of plant called a tarweed. I'm not a botanist. They're little weedy flowers. They have green leaves and yellow flowers. There are some tens of species in the continental Americas. They look similar to each other. You need to look carefully to distinguish them. One, and only one of those species got blown west, and once it got there, all hell broke loose, right? So these things are what are called the Hawaiian Silver Sword Alliance. They do not look, either in size or form, anything like what they came from, but molecular evidence makes it unequivocally true that they arose from the tarweed family and from a single species of that family, and this diversity has appeared over roughly the last 5 million years. So this is crazy. Okay? So here's a model for how novelty arises in situations like this, and I want to emphasize, I should say speculation, it's not really a model, and so I need to emphasize the speculation. I'm one of the people who believes that biology suffers from too little rather than too much speculation. Okay, it just has to be labeled carefully. Okay, so here is a diagram, thanks to R.A. Fisher. Imagine that the genotype is described by a two-dimensional space, which would be great if you were a two-base organism, because one axis would be A, G, C, and T, and so would the other. And the dimension reduction involved here probably does serious violence to what happens in the real world. But because we can only think in three dimensions, we're going to use this diagram. So genotype is X and Y, and reproductive fitness is Z. And so because there is a balance between the occurrence of beneficial and deleterious mutations at steady state, typically a population in some stable environment where nothing is changing very much should eventually get to a point where it exists in some sort of distribution near the top of the population, because if you get right to the top, there are no more beneficial mutations available, and deleterious mutations will occur, and you slide down a bit. Okay? And so now we can ask, what happens if we have mutations? And the Fisher argument is, geometrically, once you get close to the top, any mutation that is too big will take you way outside this peak and you will fall off. So only little teeny-weeny mutations can make you more fit. And this makes Darwin's ghost very happy, because Darwin is the original Mr. Very, Very Gradual Change that everyone can believe in. And his contemporaries, like Galton and Huxley, argued with him that he was probably wrong about this, but because of sort of social norms and things like this, Darwin felt himself philosophically compelled to argue that the only mutations that ever made things more fit increase things tiny, tiny bits at a time. Okay? And if you have a big effect mutation, it could in principle take you to some other fitness peak, right? Some other set of genotypes that were reasonably fit in this environment. But by that same sort of geometrical argument, it is more likely than not to take you rather close to the base rather than the top of this distribution, just probabilistically. Okay? But it could be the case that the original genotype in niche 1 is completely unfit in some other niche, niche 2, and cannot survive there. But having had this large effect mutation ended up on this different fitness peak, you may now migrate into niche 2, where this fitness peak is much higher because the interactions in that niche are different. And you could, in principle, by mutation, climb up to the top of this peak and be happy in a new home. Okay? And so the argument that I'm going to make is that in some complicated, crowded ecosystem, the Amazonian rainforest or Pacific kelp forest, where there are many, many thousands of species, the communities have been stable for many millions of years, everyone has done a good job of fighting with their neighbors, there's all sorts of constant conflict, arms races, and so the Red Queen is alive and well. What happens if you get this sort of large effect mutation that will allow you to go to someone else's niche is you get there and you find out that the niche is occupied, and it's occupied by someone who is bigger, better, and nastier than you, especially because you're not very far up the fitness peak. You are outcompeted, and thus you are a hopeless monster. But if you've just gotten to Hawaii and there are many hundreds, perhaps many thousands of unoccupied niches where all you need to do is have net reproductive success, as long as your fitness is high enough to favor the increase of your population in that niche, you're okay. So if you're an asexual population, you survive if the absolute, not the mean value of the fitness is greater than 1. And in principle, you can climb up this peak rather fast by making things that a geneticist would call suppressor mutations, because they're large fitness effects to be had by going up the peak. And maybe this is how novelty arises. And coming back to the question that you asked before, it might well be true that this large effect mutation actually killed the function of a gene and altered the genetic and physiological wiring of an organism so it could survive in a different niche. And if the niches are unoccupied, the race is to get there first. Because if once you get there, you can relatively rapidly increase your fitness, for example, by making suppressor mutations. It's not who gets to the niche fittest that matters, it's who gets to the niche first. And since the target size for mutations that will inactivate gene is so much larger than the target size for mutations that will improve the biochemical functions of genes, the relative probability of mutations and therefore the rate of mutations that inactivate genes is going to be much higher. And this will be the preferred pathway, which is why I said at the beginning, it's so important to think about the relative probability of different paths if you want to speculate about how evolution works. Okay, and last but not least, the mutant is a hopeful monster. Yes?
So the niche doesn't have to be fully unoccupied, right? I mean, you can understand statistically if a population declines in that niche is 95%.
Absolutely.
That's just...
Yeah, I'm just giving you the simplest possible cartoon. No, it doesn't have to be.
Can you say the proposed trajectory? I have kind of a spectrum. Yeah.
You have a large mutation that reduces fitness in niche 1 substantially. But it allows this genotype to survive in niche 2 at all, which would otherwise not be true. Because this niche is unoccupied, the requirement is that you be able to have net increase of the population there. You don't have to beat out the local inhabitants. And as a result, as long as there are mutations that you can take you relatively quickly up this peak, if other guys got there in a slower way, then in principle put them up here, right? As long as you've gone up the peak quickly, they're too late.
So you use this first mutation to climb up?
Quickly, yeah. Okay? That's the idea. Okay. And so this is a slight digression because it's going to explain the selection we did that is going to perhaps exemplify what I just talked about. And so we're having an unpleasant intellectual transition at 30,000 feet. When I was working at this talk yesterday, the oxygen is too thin. Actually, effectively, you're at about 10,000 feet inside an aircraft for the brain to work efficiently to produce a better transition. So, sorry, jump. Okay, but we're in California, Hollywood, jump cut, it's all fine. Okay, so the argument is that much of evolution is a selection for computation. And what I'm going to mean by that is, following John Hopfield, a computation is any rule-based transformation of symbols one into another. And here is an example. This is a French phrase, filet à l'anglaise. And its moral equivalent is this English phrase. Okay, this literally means to leave like the English. And this would be filet à la française. Okay, but they both mean the same thing. In the two different countries, these are phrases which means leaving without asking permission. Okay, and it's a reflection of the relative amity of the English and French that they use this thing. Okay, and so the argument I'm going to make is that one of the selections, one of the computations that organisms do is to predict the future, because evolution is dominated by two things, reproduction and survival, and environments change. So what you would like to do is to be able to design your strategy as best you can to survive not only in your current environment, but in the ones that shall follow it. Okay? So here is a prediction machine. This is Theodore Williams, aka the Splendid Splinter. Okay? He is trying to hit a baseball. If you're a Major League Baseball hitter, and the pitcher is throwing the ball at 95 miles an hour, the speed of human reactions and detection and neural processing means you have to decide whether you will swing and where you will swing when the ball is 20 feet out of the pitcher's hand. The distance it travels from the pitcher to the bat is about 60 feet. That's why hitting the ball successfully 40% of the time constitutes a success that has not been replicated since 1946. Okay? This is our friend bacteriophage lambda. So very beautiful experiments done by a French scientist, Philippe Kurelski, in the 1970s showed, and sorry, what I have to say to remind you is when lambda infects a bacteria, it can do one of two things. It can replicate actively, produce roughly 100 more phage, and burst the bacterium. That's called lysis. Or it can quietly and stealthily integrate into the bacterial genome, not make any of the viral proteins except a single repressor, and be propagated with the bacteria until some time where it decides to reactivate itself. That's called lysogeny. And so what Kurelski showed is if, on average, there is one infectious bacterium per E. coli, you get predominantly lysis. But if you do the same experiment where on average, there are two infectious lambda particles per E. coli. You predominantly get lysogeny. Okay, that was just an observation. Since then, statistical physicists have argued that that means that lambda has learned something about Poisson counting, which is there's only one of you inside a cell. It means that the probability there are a substantial number of uninfected cells that your progeny can infect is high, whereas if there are two, the probability goes down by a factor of E. Okay? Okay. And this is Harrison's chronometer, which enabled the British Navy to actually know where they were in an east-west direction, whereas the French did not. Okay? And so on the basis that the prediction is an interesting thing, and so one of the things, sorry, I should go backwards. People are like, oh, but organisms don't predict. those of you who arrived here from many degrees of longitude away will be acutely aware that you can predict, your body predicts what time day and night is because you have the predictions all wrong at the moment because you've moved relative to the sun's going up and down. And so the classical example of a biological clock is the circadian clock. Oh, thank you, sorry. So there are two people who got this idea that there is selection for prediction into print because we wanted to do serious experiments. And so this is Said Tavazoy and this is Zaki Pilpel, who both did experiments where they argued that there is prediction and they argued that you could, if you selected, the prediction might go away if you put organisms under conditions where the predictions are no longer valid. They both have to do with E. coli entering your mouth and arriving in your stomach. One is about temperature and oxygen concentration, which is the Tavazoy one, and the Pilpel one is about when you encounter lactose and when you encounter maltose as you go down the human gut. Sorry, thank you. Yes?
This would be related to selection for vet hedging phenotypes too, right? Because sometimes that sort of population making,
well, it doesn't have to be vet hedging. You can always make exactly the same prediction. So the important thing about, so vet hedging is the idea that different individuals pick different strategies, okay? Bet hedging should only ever happen if genetically related individuals are likely to live in the same environment, okay? Because if no one like you is going to be around in your environment, you shouldn't hedge bets. You should just always make the best possible prediction, right? There will never be a benefit to having two alternative strategies, okay? Well, we can talk about it later, yeah. But that's guaranteed to be true. Yes? Thank you. No, thank, absolutely. Thank you. That's a very important point. Sorry. Yes. You make a critical point. So every time, so if you talk about prediction in front of evolutionary biologists, classically well-trained evolutionary biologists, there's all sorts of seat fidgeting going on and people looking angry. And that's because of something called the anticipatory evolutionary fallacy, which is you should not be able to evolve to respond to some problem you have never encountered in the past, because that violates all the rules of natural selection. And so the point you just made, thank you very much, is a critical one. You are making predictions based on correlations that you have observed in the past. It's exactly like Pavlov's dog. Ding, 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 ding. 10 minutes later, food comes. Ding, 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 ding. 10 minutes later, food comes. Eventually, you salivate at the sound of the bell, right? And so one of the interesting questions is, to what extent is it worth organisms not only saying, well, because this is in my environment now, this is what it might look like in 10 minutes, but is it worth them saying, I recorded what the environment looked like half an hour ago, and 20 minutes ago, and 10 minutes ago, and now, and based on that time series of information, I can make a better prediction, right? And do organisms, you know, as our nervous systems do, store information over time to make computations about what the future looks like? And can that happen in things like single-cell organisms? It happens in bacterial chemotaxis, because what they do is measure rates of change in the occupancy of receptors to decide what to do next. They don't take an instantaneous value. They're measuring rates of change. Okay, so that's another example of prediction. Okay, so this is Greg Wildenberg, who did the experiments I'm going to talk about. And the experiments are asked, can we evolve a circadian oscillator in yeast? As far as we know, the budding yeast does not have a circadian clock, although other fungi like Neurospora certainly do. Okay. And so the idea was to take a promoter, which is known from the work of others, in this case Jerry Fink's lab, to be epigenetically variable in its expression, and to hook that promoter up, or the promoter of that gene, FLO1, up to a fluorescent protein. And then we wanted a control, so the control is to take a promoter that, as far as we know, is expressed at relatively constant levels over a wide variety of conditions, and hook it up, its promoter up to a different color fluorescent protein. And to make everything go faster, this strain has about 100-fold elevation in its mutation rate, so it's making about half a mutation per genome per generation. And that's made by manipulating one of the DNA polymerases so it can no longer proofread, that is, go back and check whether it just put the right nucleotide in or not. And then we perform multiple rounds of selection, and this... I can, but it turns out to be irrelevant to what actually happened. So what the Finck lab showed is this is going to be a red herring. It's important to point out it's a red herring, but no, but it will take a second to describe. This is a gene that is involved in flocculation, the ability of yeast cells to bump into and stick to each other. It's like Velcro, molecular Velcro. And because that's a property that's known to show variation with environment, the Finck lab, who worked on this problem, had shown that you can get, in a constant genotype, strong variation in the expression of this gene from cell to cell. And we just thought, like, oh, that's a good way. You know, we'll have less work to do if we pick something like that. As far as we can tell, that turned out to be totally irrelevant to the selection, but that's what the gene is. Okay. So the selection scheme is we use a fluorescence-activated cell sorter, which is just a device which drops yeast cells past a laser one by one, records the fluorescence, and then by deflecting the drops, you can select cells that have particular levels of brightness. So the idea is that every morning, Greg would come in. He would put a few cells through the machine first to figure out what the distribution looks like, and then in the morning, he takes the dim cells. He lets them divide all day. Remember, they're dividing about every hour and a half, so they get through about 6 divisions. So even though you take the dimmest cells, they, within 6 generations, have recreated exactly the same distribution. And then at night, you just take the brightest guys. They now divide through the night, so in the morning, they've recreated this distribution, and you take the dimmest ones again. And you just keep going and ask if anything interesting happens. Okay, and yes? It doesn't mean anything. It just means we did the selections roughly every 12 hours, okay? And it, at least I find it easier to think about and describe the experiment by saying morning and evening. Greg doesn't, and he hates it when I do this. And he just says high and low for high and low selection. Yeah, but there's no, they don't, the design of the experiment is that they should not be able to know whether it's morning or night, okay? So calling it morning, well, it's technically when Greg did it, okay? It means nothing to the cells. And I find it easier to think about the experiment this way, but other people find it more confusing. Okay? So this is the genotype of the strain, so they're haploid cells. I've explained what these things are. He took the dimmest 6% of the cells when he selected for low fluorescence, which he did in the morning. And the high selection was to take the brightest 6% of the cells, which Greg did in the evening. And round and round. So this is the first round. And so this is what it looked like before the low selection was done. That is after they'd grown for 12 hours, and this is what they looked like before the high selection was done. And this variation here, so this is the level of fluorescence on a log scale, this is the number of cells in each bin. These look different just because there's some statistical fluctuation in how the profile looks. And so this is taking this distribution and plotting it here. So this is what the evolved population looks like before you do the selection for dim cells, okay? And this is what it looks like before, The black is this distribution. The red is the evolved population after 30 cycles, so a month, right? Roughly 500 cell divisions. And this is what they look like in the evening. So they look a little different. So inspired by that, Greg isolated clones from this population and tested the clones. And in the clones, the difference is stronger. And what I'm going to point out here is this is the fluorescence that we selected on. This is the FLO1 promoter hooked up to YFP. Okay? We didn't do selection on the red color. Okay? So this is one of those claims, but now we're looking at the red. So this is the Act 1 promoter driving RFP. This is the morning. This is before we select for low, and this is before we select for high. And these are obviously qualitatively different. And I was like, oh, great, you know, this is great. You know, we haven't gotten it all the way, just keep selecting. And at a certain point, we were like, okay, study cells, not fax profiles. And he actually looked at the cells under the microscope. So this is what they look like in the morning. So this is a typical yeast population. Here's a cell which is just budding there. And there's someone with a bigger bud and a bigger bud. And there's a little bit of stickiness. So that's what yeast cells look like. And in the evening, they look like this. So what the fax machine is doing is actually counting not fluorescence per cell, but fluorescence per event. And we could, and perhaps should, have set up the fax machine. So you can set it up so that you guarantee you're looking at single cells, because you can look at the temporal breadth of the fluorescence profile. But we were sort of lazy and we didn't do that. We thought we were going to select for more or less fluorescence per cell. It turns out quantitatively, the fluorescence per cell has not changed one whit. But the number of cells in an event that the fax machine counts has changed considerably. Okay? And so coming back to your question about, do the cells know whether it's morning or night or not? If you take the populations and you look at them just before you select for low fluorescence, which is labeled morning here, or just before you select for high fluorescence, which is labeled evening here, and you look at the number of cells per clump, in the morning, most of the clumps are small, and in the night, most of them are big. If you take the culture and you freeze it down, okay, which is somehow, you know, screws up the synchrony of whatever is going on inside the cells, and then you thaw it out again, and you grow up a population of cells, and you don't put it through the fax machine, so it doesn't know what's morning and night, but you know what morning and night in the laboratory are. So this is testing. Is there some hidden environmental variable that these cells are responding to? The answer is not, because those two populations look the same. Okay? And so the other thing that I should say very, very importantly is, in your circadian clock, there is entrainment. Right? Those of you who arrived from India or Europe, eventually everything will be fine because your clock will readjust to the fluctuation of life with the perfect Santa Barbara and red weather. Okay? And in fact, the clock inside you typically runs with a slightly different period from 24 hours, like typically for humans about 25. So if you went down and lived in a very dark cave underground with fluorescent lights but with no temperature variation, you were cut off from the interweb so you wouldn't know by the new cycle what was going on, your clock would free run. Okay? What we're doing here is what is called selection synchrony. It's like we go to an airport, we measure the time on everyone's circadian clock, and we take everyone who's on Tokyo time and we euthanize the rest. Okay, so we're doing what's called selection synchrony. And so one of the things that Greg did, which I'm not going to show you, is to show that this clock will free run without seeing the fax machine for at least three cycles. So it is at least an oscillator, right? So it's like my watch here, which comes from Timex and is purchased every 3 years at Walgreens when the strap breaks, not the actual watch. It has an oscillator inside. It's useful as a watch because I can set it. Right? We don't set these guys. It's just like you go into the Timex factory and you take all the ones that say precisely 11:46. And one of the things we'd like to do is further evolve this clock so we can entrain it. But the very last thing that I want to do, yes. Well, that's what we thought we were doing. Yeah, we pick singles, so what's happened is what we've evolved is there is some oscillator which controls the clumpiness within the population, right? And I can tell you about the mutations that produce that, okay? Okay, and so the experiment that Greg did is take cells at the single phase period of the population, right, because we've done this induction synchrony on the population. We chemically stain those cells in the cartoon at least yellow. And so their progeny will not be stained. Okay? And so we can ask, what happens. And so during our subjective day, this progeny stick to their mum, and you build up clumps where there's a single yellow, a single labeled cell surrounded by unlabeled cells. Okay? At this stage, we take a population and we dye everyone yellow. Okay, so now in the clumps, everyone is dyed, chemically dyed. And now we follow during the subjective night, and what we see is unlabeled cells appear within the clump because there is cell division going on. And also the clumps break up, and the progeny of these unlabeled cells are mostly not clumpy, and that's how we go around the cycle. So during the day, single cells give rise to clumps, and during the night, clumps give rise to single cells, and single cells, when they proliferate, typically give rise to other single cells. Okay, so there's a cyclical variation in the stickiness of the population, it turns out. Yeah, so these cells are, it's Velcro. Yeah, so you can do that, right? And what's worth saying is the Velcro is not very strong, and so we think that what actually happens is that in these experiments, these cells never diffuse off into population. They stick to their mothers, okay? So it appears when you do this sort of experiment where you don't sonicate them that there's sort of lineage restriction to this. But we think it's just because when the cells divide, their walls are initially connected together, the wall breaks between them, but they're very close to each other. So the sort of the probability of collision and their ability to hang on to each other is much higher than if they just randomly banged into each other.
I guess what I'm wondering if you physically separated them, like with a sonicator or some other method, and you still selected for higher expression, but now the single cells, would you get a different oscillator that was more about kind of
So we thought we were going to select for variations in gene expression over a cycle, okay? But, you know, that's why we did it with this epigenetically variable thing, because we thought we would somehow channel noise to oscillate, you know, so it wouldn't be noise anymore, it'd be a regular oscillation. I don't know if that selection actually works, because it's not what we did, but we instead accidentally did something else. Okay? It's like the Rolling Stones song. Sometimes you get what you need. Okay? And so these are the actual pictures from this experiment. So these are microscope fields. So you can see there's a single, now it's greenish yellow cell in a clump. Clumps get bigger. Now we label the clumps. Unlabeled cells appear within them, and over time, the clumps get smaller, and also the labeled cells get diluted out. So in these pictures, most of the cells are unlabeled. Okay? So what we want to do is find the mutations that cause this phenotype. We have a problem because we used a mutator, and there's roughly one mutation occurring every other cell division, and most of these mutations are neutral and have nothing to do with the phenotype. Just sequencing is not very helpful. So what we do is we cross the evolved strain to its ancestor. We collect spores, and then we run our cycle and select for the guys who have this property, right? So we throw away the vast majority of the progeny because they're not going to oscillate in this way. And then we sequence at high coverage this population of selected genotypes. And so in cartoon form, what that means is here's our evolved strain. There are red mutations which cause the phenotype, but they are vastly outnumbered by green mutations, which are approximately neutral and have nothing to do with the phenotype. We cross these guys together. We select only those progeny that have the selected phenotype, so they'd better have the red mutation. Okay? And now we sequence. So the frequency of these alleles in that selected population is going to be close to 1. Close to 100%. These guys statistically should be exactly at 50% if you make big enough pools. And so then John Koshman, who was a postdoc in the lab, wrote a nice software stream that pulls out the candidate guys. And then what you do, and I'm not going to show you in the interest of time, you re-engineer all of these mutations back into the ancestral strain, and you see if you recreate the phenotype. And that was done for this red population of guys here. And in the same flask, Greg ended up with at least 4 different genotypes. These two share six mutations, but they differ after a certain point. And then there's another entirely different lineage where one of the genes is mutated in both of these lineages, but it's different mutations in the same gene. So these are clearly parallel evolutionary events in the same population. So this is the one that Greg recreated. So he re-engineered all of these mutations back in and showed that those recreated strains produce the same oscillation. So we look at an absolute level of fluorescence, and cells are classified in F25 in the bottom 25% of fluorescence values, and F75 if they're in the top 25%, and we plot the log of that ratio. Okay? If you don't synchronize the evolved population, so you just take it out of the freezer and grow it without putting it through the fax machine and selecting, or you can put it through the fax machine and just not select on fluorescence, you see some sort of minor oscillation in this value, and it's close to zero. If you do the synchronization where you select at one time point for low and the next one for high and back and forth, so you get everyone in the same phase, you take all the people on Tokyo time, this ratio fluctuates in the way we expect. And this is the recreated strain without synchronization and with synchronization. And if you plot these two on top of each other, they're basically superimposable. We haven't tried. It's a great question. How flexible is it? And can we select genetically to alter the period with further mutation? Because that's the way that the mutations that really identify the core of the natural oscillators were isolated. We just haven't done it. Okay, so who are these genes that have been mutated? Okay, there is a prize. You produce a hypothesis for how this collection of mutations produces an oscillator. We test it, you're right, I pay you $500. Okay, because we're a bit stuck. So these are the names of the yeast genes. This is a mutation. This means that the nucleotides that specify valine at codon 37 now specify phenylalanine. The stars means they specify a stop codon, so these are essentially guaranteed to be loss of function mutations in these genes. I think that's a typo. Sorry. And these are the annotated functions, and for some of these genes, this is inference by homology, and some of them it's detailed yeast studies and we really know what they do. This mutation makes cells think they're diploids, and in all the independent lineages that Greg looked like at, the cells think they're diploids, okay, even though they're haploids. Okay? And so that probably is telling us that yeast spend most of their time in their natural ecology as diploids. There is probably more phenotypic variability available, and they're sort of trying to tap into that by making mutations that make them, even though they have one copy of the normal mating type information, express a silent copy so that they think that they're diploids. And then these other things are just involved in all sorts of different things, and there's no easy way to come up with any sort of sensible hypothesis about how you construct an oscillator, especially when apparently all of these are loss of function mutations, because at least individually, each one of these fancy causative alleles can be replaced by deleting the gene without destroying the ability to oscillate. Okay? So it comes back to the question you asked about laboratory evolution mostly killing genes, which is why I made the speculation that this may, at least for the evolution of novelty, be the way that evolution actually does it. And so one of the things we're interested in doing is talking to people about what things you might be able to do to explore natural evolutionary radiation laboratories like Hawaii to look for signatures, genetic signatures, that might tell you that genes have been inactivated. And that's it.